My career, as many know, has been as Chief Compliance Officer for almost 40 years with JP Morgan, General Electric, Global CCO with S&P Global Ratings, and four foreign banks, including most recently BNP Paribas.
In this episode, I bring back one of the most interesting guests that I've had over the years, and that's Eric Young. Eric started in compliance before there was a compliance. He started with the Fed back in 1980 and has been in compliance, internal controls, risk management from the financial perspective until he retired recently and is now at Guidepost Solutions. Eric and I take a look at the evolution of the role of the Chief Compliance Officer and why Eric thinks the McDonald's decision out of Delaware is a true game changer. First, a quick message from our sponsor. Hello, everyone. This is Tom Fox, back for another episode, and man, you are in for a treat today. I have back with me Eric Young. Eric is now well-known to the compliance community because of his work in both thought leadership and publishing his own book with his own story, and we're going to take a look at what I think are some very significant evolutions or changes in compliance and specifically for CCOs over the past year. So, Eric, first of all, welcome back, and thank you again for taking the time to visit with me.
Absolutely. It's great to be back. Good to see you, Tom.
Eric, could you remind our audience of your professional background and your current role?
So I joined Guidepost Solutions January 2021, so just over a year. They're a monitoring, compliance, and investigative firm globally. Great firm. I really enjoy being there. My career, as many know, has been as Chief Compliance Officer for almost 40 years with JP Morgan, General Electric, Global CCO with S&P Global Ratings, and four foreign banks, including most recently BNP Paribas. I presently teach at Fordham Law, Ethics and Compliance, and wrote a book, not as good as yours, Tom. Congratulations again. But it's on professional lessons learned, but also six sets of recommendations structurally and legislatively to create sustainable, effective compliance programs. Happy to do that.
So, Eric, I want to go back about a year, not quite a year, maybe 11 months, and for our review today, start with a speech where Kenneth Polite, the Assistant Attorney U.S. General, Assistant Deputy Attorney U.S. General, rather, announced a new requirement going forward for CCOs whose companies have gone through an enforcement action that now have to certify at the conclusion of the deferred prosecution agreement or other settlement resolution that the compliance program was effective and would effective for the obligations they had under the DPA. And there's been a lot of discussion about this in the compliance community. Some have worried that this may put some liability on CCOs where it didn't have before. Others have worried, well, how would you ever do this? I kind of came down on the side of, well, it was mandated under Sarbanes-Oxley, Section 404, and I think there's a way we could figure out to do it. Some have said, well, that really is in opposite. But does this, in your opinion, the CCO certification empower or hurt a CCO in the unique circumstances of one whose company has gone through an enforcement action?
I've long believed that certifications work, and we can get into that later. But in my view, and Tom, you and I were at that speech, if I recall it, the Compliance Week forum, is that CCOs, yes, are empowered, or at least have the ability to be more empowered with these certifications, because it connects the CEO and the CCO at the hip, where they always should have been, in my view, around authority, seniority, and ability to drive the compliance budget, whether for the function itself or as owned by businesses and functions where compliance risks actually should be managed directly.
I have talked to several of my friends and colleagues over the years who have been in this position, and they have pretty much to a person said, this is the one time when you have everyone's attention. And you tend to get, if you're ever going to get resources, whether dollars or headcount, it's now during the pendency of a deferred prosecution agreement. So would this be one other piece of ammunition or information a CCO could use to get more resources, at least during the pendency of the deferred prosecution or other settlement agreement?
Yes, for a couple reasons. And the reason why I said CCO should always be empowered and when this would help CCOs is because certifications, if done right, done well, will compel business heads, C-suite, other functional leaders to map out their processes and, more importantly, identify controls, and especially control gaps. And in that sense, it's the identification, prioritization of control gaps driven by risk assessments that will document, provide an audit trail, and compel these sub-certifiers to own up to these control gaps, including compliance. And therefore, it's not just the CCO crying wolf, if you will, but a detailed, granular audit trail of processes that either work or don't work in practice, as the paraphrasing the DOJ's sets and guidelines and evaluation of corporate compliance, guidance and expectations. So if the culture is right, the budget will grow because the certifications will drive the identification of gaps. The one point I'll underscore, having said all of that, the key phrase is deferred prosecution agreement. So by the time these certifications are signed, remediation should have already occurred. And that means something bad, recidivist or otherwise, has already happened. The key is moving up these type of processes, including certification, before it's too late, before there's a violation, particularly big ones, or in order to drive and change the corporate culture. That's the real challenge, is to have it designed right, adequately resourced, and then working in practice, as opposed to it being too late after a lot of reputational damage, headlines, and penalties.
Previously, the test seemed to be twofold or two-part. Number one, have you created an effective compliance program? And then have you tested it? And if you had tested it and your testing demonstrated the effectiveness, that would seem to have been enough. I guess my worry, Eric, is that now we have this third step, which is the certification. But what happens if 3 months after certification, there's a call to the whistleblower line? Or there's a above-the-fold report in the New York Times or Wall Street Journal, or your internal controls pick up something. Is a CCO put him or herself in a position of potential liability, or do you think the DOJ or other regulatory body would see this, if it's picked up internally, as a working program?
Let's assume that the certification process is a work in progress for the working program, to play a little bit on words. But if designed well, including the certification process, then there has to be a level of reasonable assurance. Nothing is absolute. That's point one. Second, things change. The external environment changes, the internal environment and risks for both external and internal also change, either because of M&A activities, new product, new technology. So the risk always changes. But most importantly, therefore, the processes, the management of these different risks, and they are wide and deep, need to keep pace. That way, the controls and the identification of control gaps will demonstrate that that whistleblower, that control breach, hopefully not above the fold, as you say, is isolated, and that the controls actually worked, and that investigations or remediation will probably both address these, isolate them, and self-disclosures occurred first within the organization, and depending on the severity and the criminality, also to the DOJ and other regulators. So timing is key. Isolation of the control weakness to demonstrate that the overall system of internal controls are actually working, and an audit trail, not only with the first certification process, but also for control risk assessments to be flagged, identified, and addressed on a continuous basis is essential.
Eric, now let's move to, I'm going to conflate the Monaco memo and changes in the corporate enforcement policy. The Monaco memo was announced in September, a formal written memo released by the Department of Justice, and then that was followed up with changes or modifications to the corporate enforcement policy going forward. So maybe I could ask you to, if you could sort of give me your initial thoughts or kind of big picture review of what the Monaco memo said, what changes it may have foreshadowed, and what changes you saw in the new corporate enforcement policy.
So the Monaco memo, to some formerly known as the Yates memo, really a couple of years ago, really underscored the intent of the DOJ prosecutors to take a wider and deeper look with respect to criminality, particularly around recidivism and the overall corporate culture to determine whether a company and its C-suite and ultimately its board got it. And it goes back to, is it adequate, well-designed, adequately resourced, and actually working in practice? The Monaco memo, through very public and wide-read speeches, either by Deputy Attorney General Monaco and Assistant AG Polite, highlighted the sticks, if you will, as opposed to the carrots of enforcement. And to some, let's call it more in tune organizations and compliance officers, welcomed it because of the continuous recidivism and just writing a check approach by many firms that they could afford to take the hit, if you will, reputationally or otherwise. Now, more recently, with speeches by Mr. Polite and Ms. Monaco, looks on a more balanced basis, recalibrating, if you will, both the carrots and the sticks, focusing in this case around the importance of self-reporting, the need to, quote-unquote, immediately escalate and report to the DOJ, as well as demonstrate that that well-designed compliance program that's adequately was budgeted and working in practice is in fact the case at the time of the misconduct and during and after remediation. So I think it's a good clarification of the CEP. It doesn't change anything per se to the extent, again, and I keep emphasizing this, is the damage has already been done, the crime's already been occurred and prosecuted. The question then is how much partial credit, which can be significant, will be given, but how much damage has been done, because it never should have got the compliance program, should have flagged and addressed this well in advance.
You know, listening to your answer, I probably should have added in the Monaco memo, the ABB FCPA settlement, and then the modifications to the corporate enforcement policy. Because in late December, we had a settlement agreement with the first three-time FCPA recidivist. And many of us began our journey through that deferred prosecution agreement, scratching our heads and wondering how ABB got the result they did with that number of FCPA violations. And one of the things that I lauded the DOJ for was that I thought they thoroughly and in detail explained how ABB was able to get what I thought was a stunning settlement given the facts. But it wasn't the DOJ giving away anything. It was what ABB earned, starting with a very close attempt to self-disclose. And there was a lot of ink on the deferred prosecution agreement about that attempt. And they I think what the DOJ was trying to communicate was, if you have an effective compliance program which picks up violations, which ABB did, the fact that the story broke in the South African press either the day before or shortly before ABB was scheduled to meet with the DOJ was given a lot of credit. But ABB engaged in extraordinary cooperation and an extraordinary remediation. And the cooperation, the only additional piece of information other than those words, extraordinary cooperation, was in the Securities and Exchange Commission order around this enforcement action. It said they basically were providing documents and information in real time to the commission and to the Department of Justice. So we had a hint or a sense of what ABB was doing during the investigative phase. And then the remediation phase was equally impressive. Now, ABB still had to certify that they were able to escape a monitor. And they did that because they put an effective compliance program in place and they were testing it and have tested it. But they are going to continue to report to the Department of Justice literally on a quarterly basis the results of that testing. And I say all that in some detail because that's how ABB, a three-time FCPA loser, got the result they did. And when the way the DOJ communicated that information, it made clear that as bad as the facts may be, if you really change your tune, and we trust that you change your tune, we will give you credit for what you prove to us. And then we saw, as you said, the carrot part came out in a corporate enforcement policy. And then when I read that, I said, okay, that's how ABB got the result. We didn't know that at the time, but now I see sort of a kind of a straight line continuum. As you called it, a recalibration, I probably would have said a little bit stronger about the recidivist part, but it did give us carrots around that, and it gave real incentive because 75% off the low range of the sentencing guidelines. I used to be a sentencing guideline calculation fanatic. Yeah. And it's still to me a mystery in many ways how they come up with that range. But if you have a $100 million fine as your low point and a $300 million as your high point, the mid-range is $200 million, and that's $100 million more. If you get a 75% discount off the low range, that's real money. And I thought that was very well explained to us from the Kenneth Elite speech. But here's the part that I really wanted to explore with you, Eric. The Kenneth Polite speech announcing the changes to the CEP talked about having an effective compliance program in place at the time of the incident. And he defined that as having controls which picked up the event leading to the self-disclosure. So that was the ABB part. And that, to my mind, was the first time we had seen anything close to the definition of an effective compliance program explained as effective controls which detect it. Now, prevent, detect, and remediate have always been a three-pronged part of any compliance program. But typically, the DOJ had focused on the effectiveness of your compliance program at the conclusion of your enforcement action. Here, they really harped on that at the time of the incident in question. Once again, a very long-winded way to ask you, did you see anything new or different that would cause you to maybe rethink what is an effective compliance program or how you might counsel a client?
So for me, particularly coming from the banking industry, which has been and continues to be highly regulated and beaten up in many ways because of similar types of issues around the lack of self-disclosure, the weakness of surveillance monitoring and reporting, especially to the board, they're further ahead than the non-banks, industrials, the technology, and other companies, and being able to identify red flags through surveillance technology, self-policing, and have an audit trail behind it, because if it's not written, then it didn't occur, so to speak, including decisions. So from that perspective, it's not new per se, but it's certainly newer, and less mature on the non-banking side. And there's much more work to go. That's point one. Point two is $100 million sounds like a lot of money, and it certainly is. But if you do more calculus in terms of many of these firms' quarterly profits, annual profits, even for those recidivists that have hundreds of millions and billions in fines and remediation and monitoring costs, that still, believe it or not, actually ends up just, for some firms, one quarter of their profits. So the question then is, how will the culture change, and how much is non-disclosure because of privilege or other issues still driving not only the decision, but also the overall culture of timing? When does a firm disclose? So in the ABB case, and hopefully others going forward, is they think privilege is important, but not necessarily paramount as it relates to the timing and the ultimate disclosure and how much disclosure is made to the DOJ and other regulators. Perhaps that's why, depending on the timing also of the actual underlying misconduct or violation at ABB, and any changes, not just in terms of remediation, but also structurally, culturally, in empowerment of the CCO, have since changed to earn that trust, in this case, the DOJ and SEC. Sure sounds like it, and it sure demonstrates that firms, however recidivist, however aggravating circumstances, still have a shot if that's the calculus that they're focusing on. But hopefully the calculus also, it includes how much is the CCO actually being paid? How where does the CCO fit in the organization? And most importantly, how accountable are the businesses and the C-suite with respect to complying every day? That's the key and the solution, if you will, and the calculus, as we like to say, that results in the net penalty. But you know, culture, accountability, they're quite intangible. And that's the key to success to an effective compliance program that's literally working in practice.
The other component re-emphasized or reoriented in the Polite speech announcing changes to CEP was extraordinary cooperation. And I tried to cite to the one line I found in the ABB enforcement action, which came to us from the Securities and Exchange Commission. I was a little troubled by Polite's explanation announcing the changes to the CEP, which was essentially, Otter Stewart, I'll know it when I see it. That doesn't provide much guidance. And many compliance professionals, many outside counsel, many in-house counsel work very hard during an enforcement action to provide the very best level of cooperation in turning over witness statements, turning over documents, making witnesses available, responding to regulator requests, whether they come from the DOJ or SEC. And they take great pride in that because they understand they're building a relationship of trust with the regulator. And now they're being asked to do something more undefined. And I don't know if that means quicker, faster. I don't know if that means picking up the phone and saying, hey, this will be there tomorrow, or I'm going to send you the e-version with hard copy to follow by FedEx. I really have struggled with how to be able to explain what goes from extraordinary cooperation to sort of double extraordinary cooperation. So I'm a little concerned about that part of it. Maybe there's something in the financial world that you've experienced over the years that could bring to bear on this question, Eric.
I would say a couple things. One is welcome to the world of CCOs, where everything is gray and quite undefined. But that's the life that we live. And all kidding aside, in some ways, that's okay from in this case, a prosecutorial point of view, because it underscores to me that the DOJ in this case, or the courts, will look at facts and circumstances on a case-by-case basis. That's a good thing. I tend to look at things with perhaps rose-colored glasses, but the facts and circumstances of the case also take into account how much has really changed since the first time, the second time, and for AVB, the third time around, again, using the metaphor of glasses. Have they put on a stronger pair of lens or a new pair of lens that enables firms to see much more clearly where the hazards are in advance, but also to pick up the flat tires along the way and to fix them along the way? So timing is everything. I would say firms should not overanalyze the words from a speech too much, but in fact, overanalyze the function, the program, as to whether it's really working, and test people's accountability, as we've seen, including on the banking side, to claw back bonuses, see what kind of message that sends, to hold people accountable, including the CEO and the C-suite, and see what happens. That will really change timely disclosure to the DOJ, and more importantly, increase trust from the DOJ.
Eric, in talking to a lot of people who do types of work like you or our lawyers, external counsel, and even in-house types, they say the most difficult question is whether or not to self-disclose. I'm going to focus on an FCPA since I'm the most comfortable with that, specifically because there is no legal obligation to self-disclose. There is significant credit under both the sentencing guidelines and now under the corporate enforcement policy, but it's still an extraordinarily difficult question. And do you feel like the Monaco memo and the changes in the corporate enforcement policy I don't want to suggest it makes the decision any easier, but do they change the calculus if you were helping or advising a company on the decision whether or not to self-disclose?
It is a tough question and not difficult answer to the extent whether case by case or who the audience is in which the advice is being given. If it's the general counsel who is trained and experienced to pause, investigate, assess, calculate, and then anticipate the risk of disclosure, criminal versus civil, and the door it may open with respect to waiving privilege, because a lot of it is driven by privilege, and I've certainly seen it on both sides, banking and non-banking. But what the DOJ is basically saying, and I've sat in rooms with regulators on the civil side, is the general counsels will literally give a one-hour lecture on the importance of privilege. And then 30 seconds later, afterwards, the regulators will say, we don't care, we want the information. And that is even in the case, especially in the case of suspicious activity reports, in which there is even FCPA, suspicion of a crime, that needs to be really weighed in terms of timely disclosure for the FinCEN or DOJ or others with respect to, was anything held back because of privilege and the concern longer term in terms of civil liability? Or did they do the right thing and let the important stakeholders know, saying we're still investigating, it's very early days, but we want to let you know? They're not mutually exclusive.
So now let me turn to two developments in corporate governance that I don't want to say came out of left field, but they have really added to me to the dialogue that you and I and many others have had literally over the past year on the role of the CCO. The first one came from the Securities and Exchange Commission in an enforcement action involving McDonald's Corporation. And the second one came from a Delaware Court of Chancery decision also involving McDonald's Corporation. The SEC order involved former CEO Steve Easterbrook, who was terminated for having a intimate relationship with a subordinate in violation of McDonald's code of conduct. And he was terminated without cause and he was given a settlement package. Later, McDonald's determined that he had had other and more inappropriate interactions and affairs in the company, and they clawed back the money they gave him. The SEC settlement action penalized McDonald's for failing to disclose its, the board's failing to disclose its reasoning and the termination of a CEO without cause. And they said that's a material information that needs to be disclosed, just the decision-making calculus. They didn't criticize McDonald's for giving him a settlement package, and they didn't criticize McDonald's when they clawed it back. It was simply that information, the disclosure of information. The second case sort of evolved out of Easterbrook's situation, but it involved a fellow named David Fairhurst, and he was what McDonald's called the chief people officer, but head of HR. Whatever Steve Easterbrook did, Brother Fairhurst was doing it on steroids, and he added an alcohol component to his in-house inappropriate behavior. He was warned about his specific behavior, and he was terminated for both sexual harassment and probably inebriation on the job. During this time, McDonald's had a problem with its culture of sexual harassment, and there was a lawsuit by franchisees claiming they didn't receive training for sexual harassment, claiming that 3/4 of all female employees of franchisees had been sexually harassed. There was a lawsuit by employees who claimed that similar number to the franchisees of female employees were sexually harassed. But equally importantly, when a report was made to HR, the proper reporting channels, fully 2/3 of the reporting women were discriminated against going forward. All of this sort of came to a head where both franchisee and employees at company-owned stores had a 10-day strike over the issue of sexual harassment. Shareholders sued David Fairhurst and Steve Easterbrook. Easterbrook was dismissed from the lawsuit because the clawbacks, saying that Easterbrook, as head of HR, had a duty of oversight and a duty to report to the board. Fairhurst. So the Delaware Supreme Court Court of Chancery, which is the trial court in Delaware, not the Supreme Court, found for the first time there was a duty of oversight of corporate officers, separate and apart from a duty of a board under Caremark. So now we have a duty of oversight, and I've been diving into this case, and I've been really interested that the court, as part of the basis for its rationale, number one, it looked to the U.S. sentencing guidelines, which put a corporate compliance program in place as a part of the sentencing guideline discount, specifically creating the chief compliance officer position. And they said that there are two positions in a corporation which have oversight over the entire company, the CEO and the chief compliance officer. It's the first time I had seen that conflation, other than perhaps CCO certification. Once again, a very long-winded way of introducing the topic. Now we have the Delaware courts, the most persuasive and important civil courts in this country around corporate law, elevating officer duty and specifically calling out the CCO as having one of the top roles in a corporation. And I looked back and I saw that theme running literally from that speech you and I both attended at Compliance Week around CCO certification all the way through. So it seemed to me to just put a button or even maybe an exclamation mark on some of the conversations you and your colleagues and myself and my colleagues have been having over the past year. And once again, a long-winded way of introducing the topic of what did you see from this decision as well?
So first, it's good to see activism from employees and franchisees in this specific case with respect to McDonald's, but it could really apply across the board to many firms. So I applaud that. Second, it is a connected dots, if you will, with respect to the sentencing guidelines and the DOJ corporate enforcement program from the top, if you will, as well as the litigation coming from the bottom. In that, and as I mentioned earlier, whistleblowing is important, and this strengthens the ability for employees to be heard, point one. Second, empowers the CCO to do their job in carrying out more directly investigations relating to whistleblowing, whether it's sexual harassment or workplace or other misconduct, suspicious or actual. We'll talk about retaliation another time, perhaps, but so it's connecting the dots from the top down and the bottom up, creating more accountability, in this case, of the C-suite. With respect to the Chancery Court and the ruling, it also connects the dot with respect to the Barnhill Marshan or Bluebell ice cream case of the Supreme Court in 2019, if I'm not mistaken, around lowering the Caremark standard, which includes not only duty of loyalty, but also care and oversight. It codifies, if you will, or at least updates the case law around who's really accountable above and beyond the board, and including the board, but pushing it down next to the C-suite. And accountability really heads home when it not only hits the executive's pockets, but also whether, you know, they're personally liable criminally or otherwise civilly. And if they see their name, their face in the papers, even beyond the extraordinary, behavior of specific individuals in this case, that accountability needs to be all day, every day, 24/7, 365, regardless of the type of misconduct. They represent the company. They need to fulfill this duty. The question then is, how large is that population? Is it the SEC-defined insiders of corporate executives? And to your earlier point, if the CCO is in fact one of two solely accountable and responsible enterprise-wide individuals, one, how come they're not in the C-suite? And two, they're not considered a corporate insider, but they, together with the board, carry the burden of personal liability. So more work needs to be done with respect to where the CCO sits, but I do welcome the fact that corporate insiders, let's call them, and executives in the C-suite in particular needs to not only be more accountable, but also transparent and timely around misdeeds, misconduct, so that the board can do their duty of loyalty, care, and oversight to shareholders and know material facts, whether good, bad, or ugly, from an investigative point of view. And it ties back to extraordinary circumstances to self-report on a timely basis to the DOJ and others, because those dots do need to be connected to earn credit. But more importantly, before the fact, prevent these things from happening, enable a safe reporting environment for whistleblowers. It's really three-dimensional. And I think many have looked at these in isolated pieces, cases, whereas you and I and others that look at things holistically can look at this as to what to do before things happen, not just how to remediate after.
Well, I think that's a really great way for us to kind of sum up and end this podcast, Eric. It's been a great exploration of being able to sit down and talk through this with you. Before we leave, though, I wanted to ask if our listeners wanted any more information on yourself, your practice at Guidepost Solutions, or maybe about your book, what would be the best place or places for them to go?
Thank you so much. I typically have a virtual screen behind me, which says Guidepost. So you can reach me or us at Guidepost at guideposts.com. You can very much find me on LinkedIn as well as Guidepost, and my book called Declaration of Independence, How Compliance and the Board Can Hold Management, Can Partner and Hold Management Accountable, can be found on Amazon next to yours. Not the bestseller that your book is, but and well done again. But those are the best ways to reach me or Guidepost Solutions. Thank you so much for having me.
Well, Eric, thank you for reaching out. This has been great fun. I can't really believe how all of these things have sort of lined up, that we can have this sort of conversation from a Kenneth Polite speech to a Deputy Attorney General speech to changes in corporate enforcement policy, SEC enforcement action, and a Delaware trial court decision all coming out and really pointing us in, I think, a very different direction going forward. So I look forward to continuing this conversation.
Likewise. Take care.
This is Tom Fox again. Thank you so much for listening to this episode of the FCPA Compliance Report. I'd like to give a shout out to our new production partner, Podflow, who helped in the audio production of this podcast. If you'd like any more information on the topics Aaron and I discussed, I wrote a four-part blog post series on changes in the role in the CCO wrought by the Delaware Court of Chancery decisions in McDonald's. I'm going to link to it in the show notes, so check that out. The award-winning FCPA Compliance Report is a production of the Compliance Podcast Network. If you'd like to be a guest on the show, please send me an email or give me a shout out. You can email me at tfox@tfoxlaw.com or connect with me on LinkedIn. Thanks again.
This podcast is a part of the C-Suite Radio Network. For more top business podcasts, visit c-suiteradio.com.